What is up, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip 338 of TFTC. I sat down with Daniel Turner, co-founder of Power the Future, to talk about energy policy in the United States and the communist tendencies of the green movement and the narrative battle that we find ourselves in at this particular point in time. It's an important one. We really need to get over the climate hysteria and the green transition hysteria. Lives depend on it. I think Daniel highlights some very key points and inconsistencies of the narrative that's being put out there. Stated end goals and actual results that don't seem to compute. This RIP was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained Capital. I mean, I'm sure if your freaks are listening to this today, you're aware of the news going on at Celsius and other yield farming lending platforms. I mean, this is why Unchained is a significantly better product. I mean, Unchained has a lending platform that is not going to rehypothecate your Bitcoin, and you can know this because they use Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. It allows you to hold a key to have some visibility into the wallet that your Bitcoin is held in, so you know that if you're paying back your loan, if you have sufficient margin, you're going to be able to get your Bitcoin back at the end of the day because you know it's not being rehypothecated out, which seems to be happening at Celsius with their blow up. Even if you don't want to engage in collateral, you don't want to use leverage. You don't want to use your Bitcoin as collateral to get a loan. Unchain has other incredible products. Their Vault, which again, leverages 2 or 3 multi-sig, allows you to eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Single sig wallets holding all your Bitcoin on an exchange. Unchain's Vault product helps you eliminate that single point of failure. It's a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. You always have control over your UTXOs. Their concierge team is here to take you from 0 to having a vault set up with 1,000 cuckbucks worth of sats in the vault. Tell them TFTC sent you. You're going to get $50 off if you're a wealthy individual, if you're somebody who's got a lot of Bitcoin, if you're a business looking to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet and you want to hold your own keys, call the concierge team at Unchained. Unchained.com/concierge. Check it out. Check out everything they got going on. New and exciting products on the way too. Just a little teaser. This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends at Brains. Price is dumping. Hash price is dumping too. If you have an ASIC out there, you have it plugged in, and it's compatible with Brains OS Plus firmware, which is an auto-tuning firmware that allows you to produce more hash and thus more sats. If you're in this hash price environment and you have an ASIC that's compatible with Brains and you're not running Brains on that ASIC, you're an idiot. Straight up idiot, leaving sats on the table. You need to be making as many sats as possible in this low hash price environment. You are an irresponsible operator of your mining operation if you have an ASIC and you're not running Brains on it. Don't be an idiot. You don't want to be an idiot. When your mom look at you and say, hey, idiot, you're not running Brains. Download it now. No, you don't. You want to go to mom and say, mom, I'm running Brains. She'd say, pat you on the head. You're like, I know I raised a very smart, sophisticated gentleman running Brains on his ASIC. Go to brains.com, BRAIINS.com. Become a sophisticated gentleman. Don't be an idiot. Don't leave sats on the table. Hash price is at like 10 cents. You get as much revenue as possible. Make it fucking happen. This was also brought to you by good friends at HODL HODL. HODL HODL is here. They're bringing you a peer-to-peer exchange, peer-to-peer lending platform, and they're running one of the most high signal Bitcoin conferences of the year in Riga, Latvia, September 3rd and 4th. There'll be events all week. The Baltic Honey Badger Conference is back, baby! Baby, it's back! I miss 2020, 2021, 2022. We're all going to meet in Riga, Latvia, September 3rd and 4th. And that whole week, there will be events. It's a cypherpunk movement for passionate Bitcoiners. It's Bitcoin only. It's going to be a bunch of key players there. And again, it's going to be a whole Riga Bitcoin week. Jack Mallers is going to be there. Adam Back's going to be there. Sailor's going to be there. Myself, Matt O'Dell. It's going to be great. Go to BalticHoneyBadger.com. Think about meeting us all down in Riga, Latvia. Later this summer, at the end of the summer. I think Hado Hado might have some announcements as well. Be on the lookout. If you want to go use their peer-to-peer exchange, HadoHado.com. If you want to use their lending platform, lend.HadoHado.com. Both products are no KYC, no AML, peer-to-peer. Great way to stack without the purview of the state over you. This rip was also brought to you by good friends at Join Crowd Health. Oh, that's the website, joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC is what you can use. This is a great way to opt out of an expensive, faceless, emotionless health insurance industry. Crowd Health is here to provide you with an alternative, and they're implementing a Bitcoin strategy as well. So basically what you do when you join Crowd Health, you sign up, and you have a monthly fee that you pay. That fee goes to a dedicated bank account that you control. At the end of the day, if you want to leave CrowdHealth, you can take the money from that bank account that you've been accumulating and take it. It's yours. But at the end of the day, you're decentralizing your healthcare. You build that account up, and if you ever have a medical expense, you bring your bill to CrowdHealth. Number one, they negotiate the price down for you. Because they do what insurance companies are supposed to do, but don't do. They go to the doctor and say, hey, let's get to a fair price here. So we'll negotiate the price down for you. You'll pay the first $500 of that bill, and then that bill will be presented to the Crowd Health community, and you will crowdsource your healthcare. Again, they're adding a Bitcoin aspect to it. Part of your monthly bill will be allocated to Bitcoin if you join the Bitcoin community, and that that you'll have a Bitcoin account built up alongside your fiat cash bank account as well. So that over the long term, if you expect to pay your monthly payments and not get sick, you can begin speculative attacking your future healthcare cost by stacking Bitcoin alongside dollars in your Crowd Health account. So go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. The first 1,000 members sign up for the Crowd Health BTC community are going to receive $99 a month. So you're going to only pay $99 a month, significant discount for the first 6 months, for the first 1,000. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Upstream Capital. I got Unchained Capital and Upstream Data mixed up there. Sorry, Steve Barber. Upstream Data. You're a miner. Again, hash price is low. Looks like ASICs are going to be on a fire sale here. So if you're looking, not investment advice, obviously. This is an ad read, not investment advice. If you're looking for low ASIC prices, the timing may be at some point this summer. If you're looking to mine at home, Upstream Data produces the black box, which is a box that allows you to put two top-of-the-line ASICs in it, and you can mine from home. Takes care of sound, takes care of heat, and takes care of fire hazards. It's a beautiful thing. If you want to mine from home, no KYC sets, no AML sets, you buy a black box, get some ASICs, throw it in there, put it on the side of your house, mine in peace. Again, no sound. Then on top of that too, oil and gas guy. Barrel of oil is pretty expensive right now. I'm sure you're making a lot of revenue. Gas. Natural gas price is pretty elevated, producing a lot of revenue as well. If you're looking to diversify those revenue streams into some Bitcoin mining, again, ASICs probably going to be on fire sale this summer. Upstream Data also builds modular containers that can live on the well pad. Even if you're a utility and you have a centralized facility, on-grid, if you're a utility company, upstream makes containers for you as well. So a whole stack. If you're an at-home miner, if you're a utility company, if you're drilling upstream on the well pad, upstream is building the infrastructure necessary for you to plug into the Bitcoin mining world. Could be a great opportunity this summer. I am an upstream data customer myself. I own a hash hut, 50 kilowatt hash hut, with the generator. So they produce a container for me. It comes with a generator. They take care of everything. And I essentially am part owner of a natural gas, stranded natural gas well somewhere in the United States. Bought the hash hut, plugged it into this well, put the ASICs in. It's been running flawlessly. We plugged it in January. We've had no downtime outside of oil changes, which we can make happen within 30 minutes. So I can attest to the quality of the product. It works. It works beautifully well. Go to upstreamdata.ca to check out all this. If you're going to buy a black box, use the code FREAKS and you'll get 5% off their bundle packages if you buy a black box and ASICs together. Use the code FREAKS, F-R-E-A-K-S, upstreamdata.ca to check out everything they have going on. If you buy one of their hash huts, their bigger huts, and you're using it at a utility or on the well pad, tell them the TFTC sent you when you fill out your form, your contact form. Tell them the TFTC sent you. If you're buying a black box, use the code FREAKS for 5% off. Enjoy this frit. Talk about energy. Upstream Data is helping monetize energy. Think about it. Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to TFTC. Starting our Monday off hot here, sitting down with Daniel Turner from Power of the Future. Daniel, how you doing?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks for having me on. And it's not hot here in rural Virginia because it's luckily it's raining today. So it's very nice. My fields need a little break.
Well, we're down here in Austin, Texas, where it feels like it's been 105 degrees for the last month straight.
But like good. It will be your first good test of the power grid in about 14 months. And let's see. I know we're going to talk energy, so let's just jump into it. Right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the grid down here in Texas is big, and it's weird to me because you have this free and open market with ERCOT and the energy capital of the United States, arguably, with all the oil and gas that we have down here. Yeah. And yet, like you mentioned, we had a blackout February 2021. Yeah. And it seems that that's the reason why I reached out to you. You run Power the Future, which is an organization attempting to bring better conversation around energy policy in the United States. And you wrote an article that highlighted a chart from NERC that basically had a map of the United States with two-thirds of the United States, particularly the western two-thirds of the United States, at elevated or severe risk of rolling blackouts this summer. And yeah. Sitting here in Texas, in what's supposed to be the energy capital of the United States, and having risk of elevated risk of blackouts this summer has me a bit uneasy, if you will. Like, how did that NERC map come to be with all this unreliable grid systems?
Yeah. I know, it's remarkable, right? I mean, it's remarkable to see policymakers make such cataclysmically bad decisions, and they make them over and over again, year after year. And, you know, I started the organization because of the folks in rural America, because they're the ones who produce our energy, right? They're the ones who they get their hands dirty. And I like to think I get my hands dirty, right? I run a farm here in Virginia, and you know, I'm up and I'm covered in manure. And so but I don't do it for a living. Right. I mean, it's supplemental income, and it's a great way to stay healthy. And I love it. but it is not my living. But there are men and women, 18 million of them, who really get their hands dirty for a living. And they work in oil and gas and coal and pipeline fitting and fracking and trucking. And they power our entire economy. You know, and they also do a lot of things. They grow our, they're the real farmers, right? They grow our food and they raise our cattle and manufacture a lot of our goods and they fight our wars, right? Rural America is where our heart and soul is found. And yet it's the brain trust in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and New York, the people whose hands are never dirty, they're the ones that make the policies, right? And they're the ones that are lobbied with hundreds of millions of dollars on an annual basis to push an agenda or to believe this or to think that, or invited to these conferences. Look at John Kerry. Every time he opens his yapper, he's in some other country sitting down at haughty tables and big wingback chairs, and they have their notes and their thing. These people haven't gotten their hands dirty in 40, 50, 60 years. And they're the ones that make policy decisions. And so how do we end up here? We ended up here because the men and women whose hands are dirty, who know the way things work, are never given a seat at the table. It's the idiots in D.C. and New York and San Francisco who think they know better. And what's the consequence of that? Well, food shortages and trucker shortages and inflation. But when it comes to energy, the result of that is, oh, yep, blackouts. They're on their way. Get ready, everyone. Blackouts are coming. And you have to scratch your head and have these conversations, Marty, which I'm glad you invited me. Have these conversations and take a step back and say, what the heck is going on, right? How did we end up here as America, as Texas? How did we end up here?
Yeah, it's something that perplexed me. So I don't know if you know the full history of this podcast, but this is a Bitcoin podcast. And we talk a lot about energy here because of the Bitcoin mining industry, which is very energy intensive. I myself have mining operations and work professionally in that space as well. And it's just over the last 4 or 5 years, particularly the Bitcoin mining industry has been getting picked on for using too much energy. And that, so that sent me personally down a rabbit hole. I was like, all right, is this really bad? Like, why are people pinpointing out Bitcoin and its energy use and picking on us for just using electricity? And so for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been down this rabbit hole of really trying to understand why energy is important, how it's produced, and what it does for humanity. And there's something weird that's really entered the psyche of the greater American public, where they believe, many people believe idiotically, that energy is bad and that humans are bad for using energy, and this mimetic force that has been thrust on us probably for the last 2 decades, starting with Al Gore and the great climate change debate, has really just made people completely illiterate when it comes to energy, how it's produced, how it's delivered, why it's important.
Yeah, and you raise a great point, which, you know, if we were going to start from the very beginning, would probably be the conclusion. But let's start at the conclusion if necessary and work backwards. You raise a great point when you say, why are they attacking Bitcoin, right? Why are we the bad guys? And the reason why is, as you and your audience know, I mean, you're decentralized, right? You are unauthoritarian, right? It's a freedom agenda. I'm not at a bit Bitcoin expert by any means, but that's why, because they don't like what Bitcoin stands for. And so your energy is the bad energy. And it raises this question. So do some people get to decide who has energy and who doesn't, right? Do some people get to decide who the winners and losers are in society? Whenever you have this command economy, right, the slippery slope towards just flat out communism. Heck, we see that with Biden's executive order to produce solar panels, right? I mean, he's using the Defense Production Act as if we're in a war, because according to him, we are in a war against climate change is the greatest existential threat mankind's facing. Ask his generals, right? You want to say, what general told you that, Biden? And are they not paying attention to China? But anyway, that is the war, the climate change war. And so he's get to use the Defense Production Act. And so we have a command economy. So you could use energy for that, because that's good energy. Right, you can use energy for mining, for lithium and cobalt for electric vehicles, because that's good energy, right? Because we like the byproduct, we like the agenda behind the byproduct, right? But Bitcoin bad energy, right? And other types of energy, will be bad. You know, I gave a conference over the weekend in Kansas talking about energy. It's what I do for a living. And I told this group of legislators, watch this summer when the grids start to falter and the utility companies have to selectively turn off sectors to protect the overall integrity, right? If you know the slightest thing about electricity or electric grids, you know it doesn't turn on and off, right? And especially it doesn't turn on. It doesn't turn on easily. So what they will do is they will shut off sectors of the grid to protect its overall integrity so the whole thing doesn't falter. And watch what neighborhoods they shut off, right? If you look at past examples, California being the best one, the most salient one, New Mexico is soon to follow. New York last year, I'm originally from New York City. You may detect the accent a little bit. New York last summer in the height of its heat wave, what neighborhoods did they turn off? Brownsville in the Bronx, right? Greenpoint, I'm sorry, in Brooklyn, Greenpoint in Brooklyn, East New York in Brooklyn. Poor, black, powerless, voiceless, they're the ones that get turned off, right? So I told these legislators, watch your electric grids across the country. And when the operators say, holy crap, the grid's going down, we got to turn off neighborhoods. Watch what neighborhoods get turned off. They're never going to be white. They're never going to be rich. They're never going to be powerful. They're never going to be influential. Malibu is fine. Right? Hollywood Hills is fine. Silicon Valley is fine. But little powerless, voiceless sectors of the Central Valley of California, they're screwed. And that's what the future of electricity and power is in America, because we start choosing winners and losers based upon political ideology.
Yeah. And I actually, before I moved to Austin, Texas, I was living in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, for about 6 years. And right as I was leaving, they shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant on the Hudson.
Yeah,
and it's so weird, the framing from that side of the energy debate, the people who want us to use less energy, the anti-human communist zealots, they frame it as we need to save humanity, we need to save humans and the planet, and we need to enact these policies, particularly anti-fossil fuel policies, because fossil fuels are polluting and hurting the poor the most. However, they'll say that, but when they implement their policy, particularly in New York, when they shut down Indian Point power plant, the results of that policy are higher electricity costs for poor, which is one of their most vital month-to-month expenses. And then, as you just mentioned, the increased possibility of their electricity being shut off.
Yeah. You look at the countries that have gone greener faster than America. It's not like we don't have a roadmap. Right. I mean, we can look at other countries around the world and say, look what they've done and look what's worked. Right. The green movement is a communist movement. Let's just make no bones about it. It's truly deeply rooted in Marxism. So all of this nonsense of for the planet or for the good, that's all just a lie. That is the cover. But the communists, all they need to do is look at history and say, where has it worked? Right. But no, nope, we're going to try it, because this time, right, ask the true believer, this time it will be the right communism and we'll make it succeed. You know, Hugo Chavez was convinced of that. And now look at the state of Venezuela. But you look at the green movement, you say, where has it worked? Right. Germany's 25 years ahead of America in going green. They pay 5 or 6 times what we pay for electricity per household. They pay 3 or 4 times what we pay for gas to fill up their car. They emit more per capita than they did 20 years ago. And now they're cowering before Russia because they are desperate for power. They're buying nuclear from France at a premium. So kudos to the French. You know, if we ever wanted to talk about nuclear and people are like, nuclear is scary. Dude, if the French can go nuclear, then the Americans can go nuclear, right? But that's aside. But look at Germany and we say, well, why do we want to follow Germany's footprints? Why do we want to follow this model? Well, no. Germany didn't do it right. We will implement the green agenda the right way. Great. Yeah, because Germans are always known for their inefficiency. Right. So I just don't know where they think it's going to succeed. And then let's centralize that to America. Look at the states that have gone greener faster. California prides itself. And it's a bipartisan pride. Right. I mean, Schwarzenegger was as green as Gavin Newsom is. Look at California. Look at what they pay for electricity. Look at the state of their electric grid. You know, they're so proud of our, we're going green. Well, you're buying coal from Oregon and Nevada. You're just paying those states more money to keep your state electric grid afloat, right? You're turning off poor neighborhoods. You have brownouts and blackouts in the middle of Dodgers games because you don't have enough power to run the city at nighttime during the summer. So why do we want to follow California's model? And you want to talk about bipartisan stupidity. This is going to get me in trouble, but you have to say it. Your state where you live now, the great state of Texas, it was Republican governors who bought into the, by X year, we got to go 25% renewable because somehow in my head, I have been convinced by the Greens that fossil fuels are bad. Just a little bit, right? Like just a little bit to say, you know what? We probably should go green by 2025 or 2030. And why? Why? Well, you know, it's good for... I will never buy any of those premises. This whole lie of renewables are clean, net zero by 2030, carbon neutral. Those are all made up lies of the left, and the right embraces that language. And then we try to play these games on their terms. And whenever you play the game with someone else's rules, you're always going to lose. And that's and Texas is losing. Quite frankly, I hate to say it. Texas is losing and they're going to lose. And you know who's going to lose the most? The 246 people who died last year in those storms because they died of the elements, because their government failed them and they are nameless. I don't know one of their names, and I do this for a living, and I don't know one of their names, but I bet you their family knows their names, and no one built them a statue and no one looted Macy's and burnt down the police station as a result. No one rioted. Just 246 people, we say, oh, wow, that's tragic. That old lady froze to death in her home because we bought into the belief that fossil fuels are bad. Ah, no, once in a lifetime storm. And if we go green faster, Marty, we'll prevent it. You can see why I don't shut up about these things, because the more you dive into them, just the angrier, but the more committed you have to get, committed to defeat them.
Yes. No, these policies are dangerous, number one. They're putting lives at risk. And then number two, I really love that you said, do not accept their frame. Do not play by their rules. We need to begin shifting the framing of this conversation and taking control of the frame, because when you try to work within the framework that these zealots give you, you're going to lose. And so that's like in the Bitcoin mining industry. That's one thing I've been pushing back on for the last 2 years, is you have a lot of people here in the United States Bitcoin mining industry who are just bending over backwards to appease the green movement, saying, hey, look how many renewable energy, how much renewable energy we used in the mine. Look at what we're incentivizing. Look at this demand response program. And like you said at the beginning of the episode, like nothing that you say, you can use 100% solar power to mine Bitcoin, and they'll just come at you and say, well, that should be used for something else eventually. Like nothing will ever be good enough for these people. And then with Texas particularly too, like you mentioned, so these green transition policies started with like Rick Perry, and then George Bush was pushing it behind the scenes as well. So yeah, it is a bipartisan issue. And I think with wind and solar, particularly here in Texas, it's like Rick Perry and George Bush just trying to grift off of credits that they could get. And like, they, I don't even think they care about the green meme. I think they care about the grift around like renewable credits and the subsidies.
Yeah, and it gets them off. It gets the renewables crowd off their back. And that's what, if you're running for office, ultimately, you know, you have to try to appease people on the other side to just get rid of that constituency. So it's easy as a fossil fuel loving Texan to say, well, let's just throw them an olive branch, right? Let's just give them. And that is, you know, there's a great radio host in your state who's also a friend of mine, Jesse Kelly. And he always talks about the communist and what the communist does. And the communist says, and one of the things I was literally texting with him over the weekend about this, the communist will he says, said something like, if they win 100 wars and conquer 99 islands in those 100, all they will think about is the one they didn't conquer. And that's the way the communists work. And that's the way the green movement works, right? They are never going to be appeased to say, well, you know what, Marty, we worked with him and now 100% of his Bitcoin mining is solar. That's not good enough, you know, until he is gone, or until they are never appeased. And so a lot of, you know, Republican governors and mayors and elected leaders will make these olive branches thinking, well, if we just work with them a little bit, you know, maybe then we can, and heck, if you want to just talk flat out politics, just wait till January of next year. Republicans will win the Senate, they'll win the House, and they will say, well, you know what, let's sit down now and have bipartisan common sense solutions to find a common cause to solve the climate issue. And it's like, well, there we go, we're done, right? And that's exactly what's going to happen, right? They're not going to put their foot down and say fossil fuels are great and they save lives and they make the world a better place. They're going to say, well, you know what, we need to work with the Bernie Sanders of the world to find solutions to, because that's what you do when you're weak, you appease. And boy, I envy the left, because they are never appeasers, right? They will not compromise on a thing. And I admire their fight. I wish we had some of it in us. I know I got it. I think you do. But boy, a lot of our elected leaders certainly do not. They do not.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I like to focus on Bitcoin, because I think a lot of the power that the left or the right, like, I personally am not a fan of politics or politician. I think voting is a losing battle. And the only way out of this mess is to actually do something. And Bitcoin allows us to do something. Most importantly, allows us to defund these activities by taking control of the money, taking it out of the government's and the central bank's hand, where you can't just print money and throw it at a bunch of renewable credits, or print money and subsidize some project that otherwise wouldn't be financed if money wasn't able to be printed out of thin air. But yeah, I mean, going back to like appeasing these zealots, like, and actually before we get to that, like, how, so I'm sure there are people listening at home like, ah, oh, these guys are just crazy conservative. Like, I'm definitely probably lean more conservative, like, to consider myself centrist, but I do believe that this movement is communist. And like, what are the, if somebody says like, all right, you're just like ad hominem calling people communists, what are like the facts that we can point to that say, no, these people want a redistribution of wealth and a state ownership of industry and central control of the economy? Like, what can we point to?
Well, energy is one of the, probably the last great industry in America that is in pretty much private hands, meaning the means of productions are in private hands. And yes, there are some publicly traded companies you can buy on the exchange, but it is not, unlike probably every other country in the world, it is not a state-run industry. And if you are a statist, maybe I'll elevate them to that level rather than call them a communist. I'll be polite for a second and say, if you're a statist, if you believe in the power of government and the power of the state, then you can't have that, right? I mean, look at, we just have an example from a decade ago. Look at Obamacare, right? You can't have healthcare in private hands, private individuals and their doctors. You need to have a central command control from the government, and we will force you onto that program. And obviously look at the results when it comes to prices, right? Has anyone's healthcare gotten better? Is anyone living longer? Is anyone thinner or healthier? Is anyone paying less? No, of course not. You know, if healthcare as in terms of real medicine has been the same, but prices have tripled, right? And that's what happens when the state gets involved. So the first proof of that is, or the first reason why I call them communists or statists, is because they cannot allow this industry to exist in the hands of the private sector. The way you get it out of the hands of the private sector is to implement the alternative, and that is the green agenda. There has been really no private sector mass wind or solar interest ever. It is all command and control. It is all state run. It is state required mandates that say, you know, by the year 2035, Austin will get X percent of its electricity from renewable. Well, that sets up market signals that says, okay, well, someone's got to start building solar panels and wind farms. Great. Who's going to be in charge of that? Who's selling the land, right? Who's making those wind and solar? And they're going to point to that and say, no, that's all the private economy. That's all the private sector. We don't own those wind and solar factories, right? We don't even own the land. It's all a private farmer. How great this is. But the only reason why it exists is because government's requiring it, right? So it is just that it is a top-down command economy. And how well does that ever work? right? There's no other indicator. There's no other moment in history that can show that a state-run command economy has been successful. It's just not. Or it's only, quote unquote, successful if you have it backed by the authoritarian power of China, where you have facial recognition and credit systems and complete censorship of freedoms and of the internet and of speech, et cetera. So, you know, if you want to look at the China to your success, well, then there you go. But the sad thing is, the scary thing is our leaders do look to China as a success. Mm-hmm. And they say that how great their system is working, if only we could have that here. But philosophically, I say this often, and I can't get past this notion, but philosophically, if in your personal life you do not live what you want the government to force others in their personal life to live, then you're not just a hypocrite, or you are truly my mortal enemy. You're right, and you need to be destroyed. I can tell you till I'm blue in the face that cigarettes are bad for you and you shouldn't smoke. And by the way, I love my cigarettes and my tobacco products, and I'm never quitting them. But I will be the first to admit that they're not good for you. But I'm not trying to ban you from doing that. And you look at the green movement and you say there are people who will tell you fossil fuels are evil and we have to get rid of them. And they want to use the power of government to do that. But in their personal life, what do they live, right? Will John Kerry ever give up his private jet or his seven homes? Michael Bloomberg has 14 homes around the world and a fleet of private jets and helicopters. Now, I don't begrudge him his wealth. And I got to tell you, if I was worth $60 billion, I would have a fleet of private jets and homes around the world as well. But Michael Bloomberg wants the rest of us to give up those raw materials of fossil fuels that will enable us to achieve wealth and prosperity. But he's not going to give them up, right? And you just see that across the board when it comes to this movement. So in their personal life, they don't want to give them up. They won't give them up, but they want to use the power of government to force you to do that. I mean, it's the same we saw during COVID, right? Where I will force the people to live a certain way, but I will exempt myself, right? Because I need to get my hair done if I'm, you know, Nancy Pelosi. I need to go on vacation if I'm Deborah Birx, right? I need to see my family. I need to. So they were exempted, and they will tell you, well, no, it was, you know, it's essential that I do it. The governor of New Mexico, Michelle Lujan Grisham, who's in a tight election, and I hope she gets destroyed, right? She had a jewelry store open so she could go shopping. She's the governor. She doesn't have to pay attention to these stupid mandates. You do. And we will come after you with the police if necessary. But I can exempt myself. The Green Movement has been doing this for 30 years. And so to answer any of your, and I get long-winded, I apologize.
No, I love it.
Long form, but I like to give the whole story. So if anyone listening is like, you tell me how they're communists. There you go, buddy. That's how they're communists. And if you don't believe that, you just need to look at the example they set. At the height of the Soviets' misery and depression and the gulags and the starvation, not one Communist Party leader was wanting for vodka or caviar. They like to say Bernie Sanders is a communist. He's not. He's a party leader. The Communist Party leaders had a great friggin' life. They had cars. They had vehicles. They had jeans. They had Rolling Stone albums. They had everything they wanted. So Bernie Sanders is not a communist. He's a Communist Party leader. We are the ones who will be the communists, meaning we will be poor, oppressed, and controlled by the state.
Yeah.
Rant over. Ask your next question.
I love it. No, I mean, you're seeing this communist, these communistic tendencies leak into private markets as well with ESG. And you have like the Black Rocks, the State Streets, Vanguards of the world using the massive amounts of capital they've accumulated passively by people who are just putting their retirement funds into the index funds managed by these companies. And then they're able to take individuals' retirement funds and then allocate it to buy shares of companies that BlackRock then gets to vote on behalf of their customers. And so they found this roundabout way to accumulate a bunch of money, buy a massive amount of shares of most of the companies that exist in public markets, and then BlackRock on behalf of their customers, even though their customers most likely don't even understand or know what's going on, begin to influence policy of these individual companies. And again, use that capital accumulation and allocation strategy to try to control private industry, or not public markets, and control whole industries will say, hey, we're not going to give you money if you don't do this, that, or the other thing, if you don't bend the knee to critical race theory, the green movement, whatever the flavor of the day is.
The one of Obama's senior advisors, a guy named Brian Deese, after Obama administration was done, he went to BlackRock and he headed up their ESG efforts for 4 straight years of the previous administration. He headed up the ESG efforts. He talked about how they were divesting from all fossil fuel products. He forced other, you know, subsidiaries to divest from fossil fuels. He led a charge to say we can no longer be because climate change is a real threat. What does Brian Deese now do? He is the head of the Biden economic team. What is the Biden economic team doing? They are using command and control to say we will have a Defense Production Act for the manufacturer of solar panels. Who do you think is invested in solar panels? Right. So you're going to tell me the guy who led a movement in the private sector for 4 years to direct trillions of dollars of or hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth into certain tranches, and now has the power of government to use government spending on those tranches? You're going to tell me, well, this is free market. You know, I am a free market person, but people who think we live in a free market sometimes need a rude awakening. There's nothing free about that, right? I mean, how does Brian Deese even have a job? The guy should be absolutely conflict of interest. And not just Brian Deese, there are 4 or 5 people in the Biden administration who have similar portfolios who were all former BlackRock guys. So you're making a great point. You know, this is the type of state-led economics that is the slippery slope towards just complete command and control economy. And then people are like, how are we $30 trillion in debt? How are we, you know, because every industry has been doing this, right? Healthcare has been doing it. Pfizer, Moderna did it the last 2 years.
Yeah, we can go all the way back to Bush Cheney with Halliburton.
Oh, God, like that. The whole defense complex has been doing it since Eisenhower, right?
Yeah.
But this is some scary stuff. And then our Congress people, it's like, we need to have a hearing about whether or not, you know, we're using the right pronouns. It's like, how about you have a hearing on these people with this enormous power? No one cares about that.
No.
You know, look at their portfolios. Look at Congress's stock portfolio. There's a great Twitter handle called Big Whales, Unusual Whales. I forget the name of it, that just tracks all the top members of Congress and how well they're doing. And you say, boy, the market's getting crushed. Not these guys. They're good. They all got out in time. It's amazing how that happens.
The Pelosi portfolio tracker, much better index than the Jim Cramer index.
Remarkable, right?
Yeah, it's we lived in this two-tiered system, and again, I don't want to inundate with you too much Bitcoin propaganda, but that's why, like, we say on this podcast a lot: fix the money, fix the world. These people can't misallocate capital and direct industry, if they don't have control of the money, which Bitcoin takes from them. Yes, it's been a tough week for the price of Bitcoin, but the inherent nature and fundamental value of the distributed network is unscathed throughout this price dump. And I think if we're ever, you just go back to Friedrich Hayek, we're never going to fix the money until we find a sly roundabout way to take it from the hands of the government. And that's what Bitcoin is. No. Once we get the money out of the hands of the government, we can begin to act like adults and actually allocate capital efficiently and properly and not have these mixed price signals enter the market via money printing and government handouts.
Anyone dumping on Bitcoin this week or Ethereum, and I do own both, you know, your argument would be valid if every other market and industry wasn't tanking simultaneously. So it's like, what? So Bitcoin is also affected by, you know, larger global markets? Well, there's a shock. Right. Well, but I mean, if the stock market were up 15% and not down, you know, then you would have maybe an argument to say it's not working. But clearly, you know, everyone is afraid of every single commodity or purchase right now. Everyone's moving to cash, and I don't blame them, because look at where we are, you know, in terms of just overall economics and current trends and where we're headed towards this recession. So if you move into cash, I don't blame you. I would move to cash. Actually, I have moved a lot to cash.
No, I mean, this is very pertinent to this discussion around energy policy. I mean, we have record high inflation or a 40-year high inflation as measured by the CPI. If you actually did a basket of goods that was representative of your everyday American's monthly consumption goods, it's probably significantly higher. And a lot of this is being driven by a few things. Number one, money printing. Number two, the attempt of the government to essentially plan the economy with the lockdowns after COVID and the repercussions of those lockdowns and poor energy policy. You have fucked up supply chains, and then the energy industry hasn't had the sufficient investment in reliable energy sources. And so we're finding ourselves in a beautiful shitstorm of policy decisions from all angles that are really putting the average American citizen in an extremely precarious situation, which is, it's, you said recession. I wouldn't be surprised that depression is around the corner. Like, I think what we're seeing right now, again, going back to like communism and the fall of empires and how things get really fucked up. You go back to Weimar Republic, and if you look at the parallels between not only the United States, I think I like to say like we're witnessing Weimar Republic part deux, but on a global scale. Like, it's happening in Europe, it's happening in the United States. You have decadence, you have you have cultural rot, you have money printing, you have shutdown of industry, all of this stuff that has happened in the last 5-6 years here in the United States and the Western world was happening in Weimar 100 years ago.
Yeah, and you have just general lawlessness, which contributes to it as well. And there's an awful lot swirling. Our elected leaders lack empathy, and I don't mean that in like the modern sense of wokeness, but in the sense that, look, it wasn't my shop that was burned down, but as an elected person who represents that district, I have to understand that for the people who own that shop or live on that street, that it's a huge deal. And I need to find, you know, if government is a problem, if government could propose a solution, if I'm not an anarchist, I really am not. But our elected leaders don't have that. And so they say, well, the baby formula shortage is a problem. But I mean, it's not really a problem for them because they don't have a shortage. You know, you probably know something about baby formula as a dad, right? I mean, you probably feel it differently than someone who doesn't have kids or someone who isn't well connected. Nancy Pelosi prides herself on like her 9,000 grandkids. Did any of them have a baby formula shortage? And if they did, you know, she would be addressing it from the podium. But it didn't bother her. And just like high gas prices don't bother them because. And so when I say that empathy is lacking, I mean that we have these elected leaders, and this goes into the very beginning when I said why I started this organization. We have these elected leaders who are so removed from the issues of the people they represent, and not only removed, sometimes they have true disdain. I mean, you look at folks running for office right now, and I am in the political space. I know you're not political, but I am in this space, and I have to follow this for a living. But you look at the folks who are running for office, and you look at almost the contempt they have for who makes up their state. You know, they want to represent San Francisco. They want to represent New York. They want a cosmopolitan. Remember they called Obama's maskless 60th birthday party a sophisticated audience? Mm-hmm. They want sophisticated constituents. But a lot of Americans aren't sophisticated in their terms. They're hardworking, blue-collar people with dirty hands who like beer and they like their local barbecue joint and they go to church and they just want to be left the hell alone on their land with their trucks and their guns. And their elected leaders hate them for that. And so how do we change that? We change it by controlling the money, right? We change it by controlling the energy. We can change it by controlling the healthcare. And then when things don't work out for them and we ship their jobs to Mexico or to China, or what are we saying? Learn to code, right? You need to find the new, you know what? I was in the process of starting this organization because I knew it needed it. I could feel the vacuum and it was bothering me so much. And there was one of those World Economic Forum meetings and I was watching it because I like to torture myself. That's why I'm a Giants fan. I like to torture myself, but I was watching it, and Michael Bloomberg and Christine Lagarde were on the panel with, I think it was Strauss-Kahn at the time, before he was arrested for...
Yeah, before he got...
raping people. And they were talking about, you know, climate change and the role. And Michael Bloomberg talked about the coal miners, you know, and he said something like, well, you know what, we put murderers in prison. You know, we get rid of people who do bad things. And look, coal miners, and I'll never forget this phrase, coal miners, we can find something else for them to do, but we need to. And then he went on. And of course, everyone in the audience all gave a polite applause. And I'm starting this organization and I'm trying to figure out what it has to do. And that was it. When I was like, when someone like Michael Bloomberg, who's worth $60, $70 billion, sits there with Christine Lagarde and Strauss-Kahn and says, we need to find something else for them to do. We the people on this stage, we the powerful, you know, something else. Do you look at your job, Marty, as something else, right? How many of people listening right now are like, I could do this or I could do something else. Just please, Michael Bloomberg, direct me what I should be doing. John Kerry, when he said, you know, the Keystone Pipeline guys, well, now they have a better option. They have a better option for a green job. And everyone clapped. And I thought, that's it. We can find something else for them. That's the empathy part. It's not us. Michael Bloomberg's daughter is fine, right? No one's coming after her $30 million horse farm in Westchester. She's cool. Right. All the John Kerry kids, all of them are fine. The grandkids, no one's coming after their job. Right. But we will find something else for them because that's the energy sector. It's nameless, faceless, powerless people. Learn to code. Right. Maybe if you make it to that level, then you can have a seat at the table. But up till then, that's the structure that America is headed into. And it is the stuff you mentioned, Weimar Republic. I've been stuck on the French Revolution for years now, and those peasants who lived under the Marquis de Lafayette or the Duke of Orléans, and you live on his land, and everything you do goes to him, and he's at Versailles, and he's been at Versailles for 4 years, and he's fat, and he's fed, and he's banging everybody, and he's effete. And he's powdering his nose and he's got little birthmarks and he's got little things in his hair and they're dancing and they're singing. And you're this peasant and all you do is work and hunger and your kids are dying and you're starving. And all you do is work and pay taxes. And then people look back and they're like, how was the French Revolution so bloody? What was wrong with these good Christian people? How is it so bloody? Because generation after generation grew up with that, and they saw their duke or their marquis or their landlord and said, I'm not just going to depose that guy. I'm going to chop him up into little itty-bitty bits and burn them on fire and stomp on his bones and grind them up into a powder, and we're going to bake it into a cake. And all of those things happened, as gross as it sounds. There's a lot of weird cannibalism after events of what they did to the noble class in the French Revolution. And people were like, oh, it was satanic. It was disgusting. It was. But after 100 years of just misery, maybe you can understand people's anger. And I hate to say it. I think we are headed in that direction. We have a fat, effete class that is ruling over us, and the people are just told, maybe we'll take your guns next. Maybe we'll take your electricity. Maybe you shouldn't have Bitcoin mining. The revolution is going to be ugly. It's going to be so ugly that I shouldn't call it the revolution before I get in trouble. The blowback is going to be so ugly that the good people of the world are just going to be so tired by that point, they're just going to sit back and watch it happen. I am sure there was a nice, noble, present woman who watched them chopping this guy to bits, who thought, this is wrong. But you know what? At that point, she was so tired, she just let it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, I think today, I could definitely see the blowback. Like, it is, I mean, we're seeing violence on the rise throughout the country. It's undeniable. People are becoming desperate, they're becoming hungry, they're unable to fill their gas tanks, they're unable to pay their electricity bills, and just as people are unable to fulfill the needs on the lower substrate of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, they're going to go out and react to that inability to take care of their most basic needs. And that typically...
Only two people in Congress know what Maslow's hierarchy of needs is, by the way. Two, maybe three. So right now you've lost almost all of Congress, but I'll let you continue.
It's you're creating the conditions. I mean, people are like, oh, these zealots, but like, you're just, again, looking at history, understanding human nature, and like, you're pushing people to the brink. And but one thing I do want to say, I do think, like going back to Learn to Code, I think one, comparing ourselves to like Weimar or the French Republic, one advantage that we have today in 2022 is this communication technology, about the ability that we're able to sit down here and have this conversation. I do think that given that we live in the information age, that we have tools like Bitcoin, a lot of the problems that existed in Weimar and French Republic were exacerbated by the fact that the peasant class and the poor classes in those civilizations didn't have any opt-out solutions, where they were forced to take the propaganda of the state that they were living under. They were forced to...
What if Twitter decides this podcast is way too dangerous, and because it's potentially threatening? Then there goes our communication. What, you know?
Yeah, then we get kicked off. Then we get kicked off Twitter. But luckily, we have podcasting, which is distributed via RSS feeds.
Not, so
we
not get until that they go to Google and MSN, Microsoft Network, MSN, yeah, and they say, or Amazon Cloud Services, and they say, you know what, this Marty guy, he is a danger. And they're like, well, now you're deplatformed from that as well.
Well, this is why Bitcoin's important. We're building. So like, there's a thing called Podcasting 2.0, started by Adam Carey, who was the original inventor of the podcast. He invented podcasting. He runs his own podcast, No Agenda, still to this day, with John C. Dvorak. And he's building Podcasting 2.0, which is an iteration on the original podcasting platform. And podcasting as a medium is truly the last bastion of decentralized distributed media, because it goes through an RSS feed. And he's found a way for, so let's say, God forbid, all the big tech companies say, all right, Marty's talking too much sense, we need to kick him off, we need to team up with PayPal, MasterCard, Visa, and cut off his ability to accept payments from advertisers or users who want to send him money. Adam Carey and team working on Podcasting 2.0 has found a way to inject Bitcoin into the RSS feed. And so actually, people are listening to this podcast right now. Thousands of individuals of the tens of thousands that listen to this show are using podcasting apps that are Podcasting 2.0 compatible. So
that's great.
They're streaming, and if, let's say, you had a Bitcoin address, a Lightning Network address, I could plug it in specifically for this episode, and people, as they listen, if they're getting value from this conversation, they could stream sats, little bits of Bitcoin to myself, yourself, my producer sitting behind the camera here automatically, and nobody can stop that. PayPal can't stop that. So in terms of creating a more robust and distributed content distribution platform, Bitcoin enables that. It's being built out. And I do think, getting back to the point that led me on this diatribe, like, we just need to win the information war. It's about narratives. And so going back to like Learn to Code, one of the most potent things that we can do with the communists and the green movement is just hold up a mirror and project. And so like Learn to Code is one of my favorite examples of that, because you have Bloomberg and all the rich elite, the champagne socialists, the limousine socialists, like saying, yeah, just go learn to code. And then you had like the New York Times and all the lapdog journalists like parroting that, like, yeah, we're just going to teach everybody code, learn to code, learn to code. Like, and you had like blue check mark journalists who would like hop into people's Menchies, who'd be like, hey, this is pretty messed up and I'm losing my coal mining job or my job on the well pad in North Dakota. And like a journalist would just hop in and say, learn to code. But again, the power of memes, the power of projection, when the media industry went through a series of layoffs, all those like lower Your average American, your blue collar worker began hopping their menchies, and the journalists were crying, woe is me. I got laid off from the New York Times. Everybody was in their mentions going, learn to code. And then they were like, oh, you guys are
They got banned off Twitter for saying that. That was considered illegal on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. But the highlights, it's like one of those things you find a glitch in the matrix where it's like, hey, you can say this to us, but we can't say it to you. And that's the power. It is literally, we have to ridicule these people. We have to make fun of them because they're idiots at the end of the day. They think they're, I go back and forth. Are they incompetent? Are they nefarious? It's probably a combination of the two. But like, I think again, framing, narrative, projecting, just hold up a mirror to these people. Like you said, like John Kerry, you're Michael Bloomberg, you're flying private jets all over the world. You got multiple houses. You actually don't believe what you're preaching here.
Yeah. And again, I don't begrudge them their wealth. You know, Bloomberg clearly created a product. He was, you know, not from a wealthy family. He created a product and did very well for himself. And he's worth $60 billion. Kudos. That's the American dream. You know, John Kerry made his money a lot easier. I'm
married.
I'd love to find a rich widow, you know.
Catch up. Who knew?
No offense, I am married. But, you know, if someone came along. But when I mentioned like the lack of empathy, it's also, and you said, is it incompetence or is it really nefarious? The incompetence / empathy is the thing that bothers me the most in the energy conversation. Because I don't think our elected leaders understand how things are made and the millions of steps. It's that iPencil story, right? The
literally
millions of transactions that had to happen for us to enjoy or purchase or participate in the economy. And I think of an example, and I don't mean to dunk on Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez because she's easy to dunk on, but this is an example of this incompetence / lack of empathy. When she was just getting started and she was, you know, trying to make a name for herself during the polar vortex in New York City. So it was winter of, I guess it was 19. She was doing an Instagram live, just like we're doing right now, except it was on Instagram. And she was cutting up fruit, making a fruit salad, talking to her viewers about how she was going to get rid of fossil fuels and how bad fossil fuels are and how the world's going to end because of climate change. And she didn't have the wherewithal or to understand that like fruit in New York City in the polar vortex is only possible because of fossil fuels, not just the production, the manufacturing, the harvesting, the transportation. But like you bought a mango, you know, at the store downstairs for whatever price at a price point you could afford, right? It's only because of fossil fuels and the whole internet streaming and the device you're streaming on and the millions of people watching you. So I look at that and I say, boy, fossil fuels are incredible. She doesn't understand that it's only possible because of fossil fuels. And then the incompetence part is she thinks it's going to be easily replicated if we have this wind and solar world. But wind and solar doesn't replace the need for plastics. It doesn't replace the need for rubber. It doesn't replace the need for nylon and for microfibers, right? It doesn't replace the ability to mine the amount of copper and graphite and gold and lead and cadmium and nickel and cobalt and lithium and all these other metals and minerals and rare earths that we need to power my laptop right now, my cell phones that are sitting here, my right. Like that's so you look at the fossil fuel world and some people only see bad. That's the communists. And they say, how can I take this over to put it in place that the way I think it should be constructed? And I look at it and say, boy, this is incredible. Look at what fossil fuels have done for mankind. Why would we ever want to tinker with it? But we have lots of tinkerers.
Well, this gets to one of the main points I wanted to touch on. I'm happy we're segueing into it now. And what we were discussing in DMs, I shared
15 minutes in, we're finally getting to the first point.
Well, I shared the video of Janet Yellen on Capitol Hill. At this point, it was like 2 weeks ago, where she was forced to come explain what's going on with inflation, and obviously we have commodities inflation, particularly in oil, natural gas, and she went in front of Congress and just bold-faced lies. So what I'm trying to get to is like, we need to, again, talking about narrative framing, she went in front of Congress and said there was no way that the United States could have insulated ourselves from the shocks to the oil and gas supply chains that are emanating from Russia and the war in Ukraine. There's nothing we could have done here to better prepare or make ourselves more energy independent, specifically around oil and gas. We're completely beholden to foreign supply chains when it comes to oil and gas markets, which means we need to really lean into wind and solar. So they're trying to right now. So like the other side, the communist side, is trying to frame things like we can't even, if we wanted to, secure ourselves with oil and gas here in the United States. The only way we can do it, make ourselves more energy secure, is to fully transition to wind and solar. And this is just an abject lie. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And there's so much to unpack there. Again, let's start with the finale and work our way backwards. China manufactures 70% of the wind and solar right now. The rare earth market, which powers them, which enables them to function, they have 95% of that market. So if you want to say, Janet Yellen, that we need to unshackle ourselves from the power of OPEC, well, then why are we shackling ourselves to the power of China? So any conversation about wind and solar, let's just separate the fact that they don't work and they're inefficient and they're incredibly expensive. Let's just pretend that they do work, right? If there's no conversation about American sovereignty and being unshackled from larger geopolitical forces, if we don't make them here in America, and there's no effort to make them here in America. I've mentioned a couple times now that the Defense Production Act authorization for solar panels, it just gives a blank check to China, right? There's no effort to say, let's make them here. It's just, we need to buy more of them. We need to get more of them. So great. A lot more 9-year-old girls are going to be constricted into labor from those Uyghur camps to start making more solar panels because Joe Biden wants them. So right there is a big fallacy. And then secondly, when it comes to oil and gas, the only reason why we're not producing more is because of the climate this administration has created, not the climate change climate, the regulatory, the economic climate that makes it a bad investment. And that just makes perfect sense. I liken it to this analogy for anyone who thinks I'm crazy. $122 a barrel. What do you mean it's not a good time to invest in oil and gas? My hometown of New York City, maybe even where you are in Austin, go to like the main street, the main area, look at how many stores are for rent, and rents are low. And people are like, this is the opportunity to open up your business or your restaurant, right? Go for it. You got inventory, you got prime real estate space, low prices. Why not buy? And you say, well, look at the climate, right? Look at the economic climate of people still working from home because of COVID fear. Look at the crime climate of smash and grabs and cops that don't have the authority to arrest people. Why would I open up a restaurant in downtown Manhattan right now? Well, it's a good opportunity. No, it's not. Wind and solar, oil and gas is the exact same thing. $122 a barrel, they should be investing. Not if I have Janet Yellen coming after my financing. Not if I have Deb Haaland, the Secretary of Interior, restricting my land use. Not if I have John Kerry and Gina McCarthy from their climate world coming after me. The Bureau of Land Management has a piece. Michael Regan at the EPA wants to chime in. The FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Richard Glick, chairman, he's got his say. So why would I invest millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, to dig more oil and gas wells if there's no climate to do it, right? It doesn't matter the price point. But all Janet Yellen needs to be asked, and this is, again, where I wish our members of Congress weren't such dolts. Well, then, Secretary Yellen, why did they do this in 2017 and 18 and 19? Right? Why were we energy independent then? Why were we producing close to 14 million barrels then, and now we're still barely at 12? What's the delta? COVID, supply chain. Climate change. Just name your Putin. Name your foil, and that's the response, right? Why was oil and gas investing hundreds of millions of dollars when the barrel price point was 65 on average, but they're not investing hundreds of millions now at 122? Joe Biden will tell you it's greed, and you're an economic mind, so think about the fun of that. We are not producing more oil and gas at highest prices in history because we're greedy. Does that make any sense? Right? Does Nike ever say, you know what, guys, these sneakers are hot. Everyone's buying them. Let's not sell anymore. Does Subway sandwiches ever say, boy, everyone wants the $5 footlong. Let's shut down production. Right? Of course you make more of something at the high price point. So if we were greedy, wouldn't we want to produce more oil? Nope. For the first time in history, greed is expressed by the lack of interest in bringing goods to market. It's fascinating. I've never seen it before.
Right. It's pretty disgusting that they're trying to paint everything as look at the greedy oil and gas guys. They're trying to gouge you at the pump. But again, we had a prime example. We had Mike Wirth, CEO of Chevron, come out 2 weeks ago. He was asked, what can we do to fix this problem? He's like, honestly, there's probably nothing we can do due to the regulatory environment that we live in today. We need more refineries and we need more pipelines, but nobody's going to invest because refineries specifically take billions of dollars and many years. The regulatory climate is such that nobody wants to allocate that capital or outlay that capital up front because they do not believe that the regulatory environment will allow them to get a return on that capital. Refineries, we need pipelines. These are, you want to talk infrastructure. These are massive infrastructure projects that we should be working on, but aren't because of the political sphere that we live in and the climate hysteria that's taken over the country.
And it's the same as the BlackRock conversation we were having earlier. They will say, this is just the way the free market works, right? It's very expensive to build a refinery, but government regulations can price people out of the economy deliberately because of politics. Proof of that is Barack Obama, who said, and he still won election, he said, I'm not going to make coal illegal. I'm just going to say, if you open a coal plant in my administration, I'm going to make you go bankrupt. And what did we do? We applauded, right? I mean, we watched it happen. So then they say, the reason why coal was going bankrupt is because of market forces. That's a market force. Right. If the market says every Big Mac has to pay a $5 tax, but the Whopper gets a dollar coupon from the government, and then they'll look at McDonald's. Boy, oh boy, look at that. That's the free markets for you, Marty. That's the free markets. And that's what they do with the industry, with the energy space. So we've got this command and control economy where we're forcing people to make and buy solar panels, but we want to have a windfall profit tax on oil and gas. And Richard Glick won't approve 10 infrastructure projects to bring our goods to market. And Deb Haaland and Michael Regan are adding layer on layer of regulation to try to drill. And then they're like, well, you know what? Free markets show that wind and solar are actually more cost efficient. Oh, please, let's take government out of the equation and see how cost efficient wind and solar are. So this is the result of the command and control economy and government picking its favorites.
Yeah. And another nuclear. So it's been 50 years since, or 30 decades. You can say that for certain. It's been decades since a new nuclear facility has been approved here in the United States. It's a purely regulatory. Nuclear energy is the most energy dense resource that we have on the planet yet. Yeah. There's an inability and unwillingness from the political power structure to allow it to flourish.
This is going to sound like I'm a socialist. I'm not. I think I've made that clear. But our energy sector should be so robust and so abundant that it should almost be free, right? Electricity should almost be free in America if we had the ability to create nuclear plants and coal plants and natural gas plants. It should be pennies because there is so much abundance of it. And then what would people do with that extra money, right? What are people not doing with their money right now because they're trying to fill up their car? They're not getting Chinese takeout, right? They're not going to vacation. They're not, because they have to pay for gas. Right. So this is where the inflation starts to eat up, or the economy starts to fall into recession, I should say, because that extra money we're not spending on other goods. And we have a consumer economy. Right. And that's just that's the way our economy functions. But not if you don't like the way the economy functions. So you would want people to spend their money on what you want them to spend it on. again, the people ask me and you know, what can we change to get oil prices down? They're never coming down while Biden is in office. Not because he's a bad guy or because he is, but not because of, you know, politics or because he's a Democrat. He's that too. It's because he doesn't believe in freedom. And if you believe in free markets, the miracle of the Trump administration, and let me sound like a Trump acolyte for a second when it comes to energy, the miracle of the Trump administration was not that we discovered a new oil or gas patch. We didn't invent a new technology or see it come online, you know, while he was in office. The miracle of the previous administration when it comes to energy is that he got out of the damn way. And when the free market is allowed to operate, it will produce more of a good for the greatest number of people possible at the lowest price point possible in the most efficient way possible. It's the way the markets will always work. Ask any 16-year-old girl who's gotten a nose job. You know, we didn't have plastic surgery abundantly 40 years ago, but it's unregulated by government in the sense that there's no health insurance premiums. There's no, right? That's what LASIK. 30 years ago, only rich people could afford LASIK. Now you get 2-for-1 specials. Why? Because insurance doesn't cover it. Comes out of pocket. And over time, it's available to more people for the greatest, for the lowest possible point in the most efficient way possible. Energy is exactly the same. So the miracle of President Trump was that he just allowed it to happen. Joe Biden does not believe in freedom. He believes in government. And he thinks he and his cadre of folks sitting around the table can come up with a solution. Last Friday in the port of Long Beach, he said, we can fix this, but we're just a couple votes short in the Senate. Government has the answer. And if only government had more power, they could, from the top down, bring, he always makes fun of trickle down. There's no more top down than him. They could come up with the solution that would benefit the most people. And those two competing philosophies of freedom versus government can never coexist. And so people say, well, what do we do to lower gas prices? Nothing, because Biden does not believe that freedom is the solution. And I think the previous administration showed that free markets in the energy spaces are allowed to operate. Look at what it did. $1.86 was the average gas price at one point in America. The only way that's possible is if you believe in freedom. And Joe Biden does not believe in freedom. He believes in government.
Yeah, the status, man, ruining the world. Hopefully the American people wake up and realize that, hey, how many times do we have to touch the stove and be burned? Like post 9/11, government steps in, Patriot Act, freedom's taken away. Post 2008, government steps in, bails out banks. We're going to begin printing a bunch of money and bleeding inflation into your life. Now, energy. Hey, we're actually going to go along with this green agenda. We're going to stop the proliferation of oil and gas and nuclear. Your energy prices are going up. That's just the cost of this transition. We need to do it. It's how many times does a state need to make your life materially worse off? Anybody out there is listening and maybe a believer that the government is the solution to our problems. Like, we just need.
I know. And I don't want to be an elected official, but I would be a governor. Not even the president, but I would be a governor, because if you look at your state and if you believe in federalism and the 10th Amendment and you believe that, you know, you could create the climate to make your state one of the greatest places in the world. Why people are flocking to Texas and Tennessee and Florida. And it's not a Republican Democrat thing. It's a freedom versus non-freedom thing. But imagine a governor having the guts to say, we're building a refinery. And like, well, Greenpeace is going to sue. I don't care. I'm going to stop them. And this, the EPA is going to come in, screw them. You know, I have to go to Alaska a lot for this job. And I talked to the governor, once or twice. And these people are 4,500 miles away. Joe Biden hasn't been to your state in 14 years, one exception. On his way to Asia, he landed his plane, refueled, didn't get off the plane, didn't talk to anyone, and then they kept going to Asia. Kamala Harris has never been to the state of Alaska. You're waiting for some people 4,500 miles away to tell you what you can do in your state. Wow, gas prices are so high. Alaska, one of the greatest oil and gas states in the nation, has to send all of its crude down to, I believe it's Northern California for a refinery, and then it comes back up. Alaska's paying almost $6.50 a barrel, a gallon, for gas because of those costs. Build a refinery. Oh, regulation. Nope, doesn't matter. Build it in a refinery. And the same with education and the same with so many other issues. Like, this is my job as the governor, is to create the conditions so that the greatest number of people have the most means of production and freedom to live their lives. It would be great to have that power, because God almighty, I know I would be good at it, but I believe in freedom, you know? And, but then again, there would be the movement stopping us, Marty, that they would say, but look at those people who were left on the side. There's always going to be people left on the side, but
yeah,
but you could create conditions. Oh, be great.
No, that's been the great silver lining of the last 2.5 years, is this thrusting onto the mainstream of federalism and states asserting their autonomy from the federal government.
Yeah.
I completely, just from a complex systems perspective, like you said, these people sit in DC, like Alaska as an example, 4,500 miles away. They're so, just from an information distillation perspective, they're so far removed from the source of the information that they yeah. can, definitionally, the way a complex system works, they cannot make good decisions for these people.
No.
They're so far away from the information. Whereas
you look at something like the Department of Education, 16,000 people work in that building. I'm about 2 hours from DC. 16,000 people work in that building. Our kids are dumber than they have ever been.
Yeah.
Do we need more of an example to say you should just be fired? What do? You know, well, we create the policies. Well, it's not working because everyone is dumb, right? I have bad news for you, but they are. Like, our kids are abysmally ill-educated, shockingly ill-educated. But there are 16,000 people and they all make $85,000 a year. And, you know, the Department of Commerce, what are the 30,000 people who, what do they do? Right. So when you say, like, I love that we're, you know, talking like decentralized, what, I'm waiting for orders for my people in the great state. Imagine if I was the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm not truly a Virginian. I've only lived here a couple of years, so I don't know if they'd ever vote me. Virginia is very proud of Virginia. But I'm the governor of the great Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm waiting for some idiot in the Department of Education to tell me about educating my kids. Oh, no. You 16,000 morons are too busy celebrating Gina's birthday and you're in the conference room. I'll take care of my kids and I'll take care of my people on energy and I'll take care of my people on every other issue under the sun. Federalism is the only solution, I think, to our problems.
Yeah. It's just create competition among states. If you want to go do these green policies and inject critical race theory into grade school curriculums, go for it. But let us, I'm an example of, I'm from Philadelphia originally, was living in New York. My whole family's up in the Northeast, but again, it's a freedom thing. Like I mentioned earlier, I try not to dive into the political realm too much, but I do. I like to consider myself somebody who loves freedom and actually cannot live. I get physically triggered if I was getting physically triggered in the New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia area due to the lockdown policies, and had to. There are opportunities down here because of Austin being one of the Bitcoin capitals of the world, but also the freedom that exists down here in Texas compared to what's going on in the Northeast was something I was naturally attracted to. And that's states competing, you know.
Yeah, and that's healthy, and industries competing against each other, right? And not having the government, you know, select for you, because again, look at the failures when government selects. You know, coal should be competing with natural gas, should be competing with nuclear if nuclear are allowed to be built, right? Make the electric grids compete, you know, for other sources of the best technology. And if wind and solar are viable options, again, they're not. I'm just trying to be polite here, you know, but make them compete, but they don't have to compete. They have mandates. And they have governors, like past Republican governors in your state and across the country, they have governors who say, well, no, we're going to make it a law that says, you know, but every Saturday, Marty and his family have to eat at least 4 heads of kale. No one loves that more than the kale growers of America. And then they say, well, you know what? Wow, the kale prices are really gone through the roof. Well, of course they have, because they're making Marty eat it. Right. Well, it's for his good. It's for his own good. And so, and that's what we're doing with wind and solar. Would they be good products? I don't know. They're not. They don't work. But could they potentially if they were allowed to compete? So you're not even doing wind and solar a favor. That's what bothers me. They will become an inferior product if they are not forced to compete against products that work, right? It will become an inferior. It will not be a good technology. Competition makes you better, right? But yeah. We're not even allowing that to happen because of mandates.
You're going
to
produce.
So we're importing crappy solar panels from China because of mandates.
Yeah, you're going to settle for like Soviet style factory goods, which are just And it's so nonsensical. Like again, wind and solar inherently unreliable because the wind doesn't always blow. The sun doesn't shine for half the day. And then other thing, you're going to electrify, like the big electrify the economy meme, particularly with like car fleets. I was listening to the No Agenda podcast, which I mentioned earlier today. And like one thing John C. Dvorak brought to my mind, like nobody's ever really thought through. Imagine having a city like New York City, 10 million people, and all the cars in the city were electric vehicles. Like it is literally impossible to create enough charging stations for all those cars to charge overnight. Like, we would not be able to build the infrastructure.
I think Elon Musk said we need about 5 times the current electricity production if we're going to have a truly electric vehicle fleet. And these are serious questions, right? So, okay, we're going to have all electric vehicles. That's the law that Biden wants to shove down our throats, and he's doing by executive order. Great. What does that require to the electric grid and to the electric grid and to transmission lines? Are we having that conversation? No. What does that require for rare earth and minerals mining and raw materials, right? We need more copper. Every electric vehicle has around 80 pounds of copper. We need more copper than we have ever mined in the history of mankind. And we've been mining copper for around 8,000 years. We need more copper than we've ever mined in the history of mankind if we're going to have electric vehicles. Do we have serious conversations about copper mining? Absolutely not. Right. So a 5-year-old kid who opens a lemonade stand intrinsically understands he needs lemons. He just knows it. Right. Like I want to open a lemonade stand, Dad. I know your kids are too young now, but just wait a couple of years. And boy, it's hot in Texas. They'll do well. Hopefully, but he knows he needs lemons. We're making this electric vehicle thing required by law, and we're not looking at sourcing the raw materials necessary. Another proof that these people are just communists. There you go. That's proof, because that's not serious economic thinking.
No. And like, it's funny. It took this just offhand comment on this podcast I listened to on the ride to this conversation. Again, think of the land use. Like if you're going to go like a complete electric vehicle fleet, like the whole, all cities are just going to be, you're bringing back phone booths and then adding an incredible amount of them on top of that, essentially with these charging stations. Like the pavements will be rows of charging stations if you actually want to make this happen. Like how ugly is that? How inconvenient is that? What is the what is the viability of actually getting that implemented?
And land use for all of the wind and solar, right? That's one of the serious conversations we don't talk about, right? Your wind farms in Texas, the biggest ones are 150,000 acres. And there's not much more that happens on those wind farms. And it's funny, by the way, the environmentalists, when they're thrilled that you're building 150,000 acres of wind farm, they never seem to find like a short-haired weasel habitat that's endangered, right? Like, so you want to drill a half acre of land, and they always find some rare, animal habitat that's endangered, or they find some sacred Native American, and this little half acre, done. But we're going to build 150,000 acres of wind turbine. Cool. Now, there's never anything sacred or rare. But anyway, how much land do we need for this much wind and solar generation? So the largest farm there in Texas, 100,000 acres, it creates around 1,000 megawatts of electricity. New York needs, on a good day, 14,000. Which would be 1.4 gigawatts for those people who love Back to the Future, 14,000 megawatts of electricity. So we need almost 2.5 million acres of land of wind, solar. Well, Brooklyn, where you lived, is 65,000 acres. Queens, where I'm from, is around 80,000 acres. Manhattan's around 30,000 acres. So what borough are we bulldozing to build all of these solar wind turbines? It's basically Connecticut, right? Which is fine. No one likes Connecticut anyway. So just bulldoze all of Connecticut, and that's where we're going to get the winter. So that's a legit conversation. And then if the environmentalists say, well, no, we're just going to put it further and further away. Well, great. Run an electric cord, you know, a mile and see if it works. You know, just keep plugging in, you know, extension cord to extension cord, and then put a lamp after a mile. Is it going to turn on? Probably not, because electricity dissipates over distance, right? Those are the laws of physics. So we're going to build a whole wind farm hundreds of miles away from New York City and just expect it to, it doesn't work that way. So these are just honest conversations we have to talk about, but we don't. So another proof they're communists, these conversations never happen. Yeah. You're just told wind and solar, shut up and wear your mask. Yeah. That's where we are.
And it's, I mean, once you try to play through the logical conclusion, if we were to attempt to do that, it's nonsensical. It's literally, you're going to pillage the earth for all its resources and take up all of its land in the process. It would be completely counterproductive to the end goal that you're stating, which is to save the environment. You literally have to destroy the environment to make this even possible.
Which, exactly. Again, one of those huge wind turbines needs around 20,000 tons of cement and rebar, right? Because you got to anchor this thing to the ground, right? Otherwise they would fly, right? So you need a serious, I mean, these are big, right? They need a serious anchor to the ground. So we dig this massive hole. We retrofit it. We fit it out with rebar, and 20,000 tons of cement is around 25 of those big cement trucks that you get stuck behind on the highway. So we need 25. How do we make cement? Well, the primary source is by burning coal, because you have to heat the aggregate to the right temperature. So we can burn coal to make cement to put 25 cement trucks worth of stuff in the ground to put up a wind turbine to make electricity. But we can't burn coal to make electricity. Okay, that's logical. How do you make solar panels, right? Well, the crystalline quartzite has to be heated to around 1,400 degrees to be put into a molten form to make the solar panels. Because it's quartz, right? It's quartz rock that has to be melted. What burns at 1,400 degrees? Coal. So we can burn coal to make solar panels to make electricity. But we can't burn coal to make electricity. Just explain that logic to me, right? Like, why is burning coal to make cement and solar panels good, but burning coal to make electricity is bad? If you believe in global climate change, right? If it's all connected, we're all one big world, well, then isn't burning coal burning coal? Why don't we burn coal in an efficient way? Nope, can't burn coal. It's bad for the environment. These are the conversations I have on a daily basis. And that's why I'm insane and I have no more hair, because I pulled it out, because this is the logic of the environmentalist.
Well, and the other thing with coal too, like coal burning power facilities have become significantly quote unquote cleaner over time too. Like,
oh, God,
there's a lot of scrubbing technology. Like, it's not as people think coal power generation, they think industrial era England with smog in the air and literal coal ash falling on society and people having a terrible quality of air. But the technology that we've created in recent decades has allowed us to create cleaner emissions while burning coal, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, dirty is a phrase that the environmental left puts on us, and I don't embrace it, even though I sometimes say it. And they say, well, coal is it is cleaner now, but it used to be dirty. I don't buy those phrases, but I understand what you're saying. But I will not let the left choose my qualifiers and my adjectives. But we have, right? We have on everything. And wind and solar, they tell me, are clean. Again, but we're burning coal to make these technologies. We're literally digging up the dirt and pouring tons of cement and rebar into the earth. But that's somehow clean. When those crystalline quartzite panels break, because they break, because they're glass-ish, right? They leach toxic chemicals into groundwater. How come we don't ever have a conversation, a serious conversation about solar panel groundwater contamination? No, solar panels are green. I got this lovely farm I have in here in Virginia. A lot of my gates are solar paneled. You get 5 days of snowfall and coverage, those gates are dead. That's one of my most annoying things, is to get out of the car and trounce through the snow and find the solar panel thing and brush off the snow. But then they need to charge for a couple hours before they can operate. Now I'm manually opening and closing all of my gates and moving, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have hundreds of thousands of acres of solar panels. Can they get covered in snow? Right? Can they get covered in dust? How are we cleaning these? Do they break? Right? What? So again, the wind doesn't always blow. The sun doesn't always shine. But things break. You know, wind turbines last 10 years. Do people know that? Right? Do you think these guys didn't run indefinitely? Solar panels last around 12 years. What are we replacing them with? What are we doing with the old ones? You know what we're doing? Literally right now, we are digging a gigantic hole in parts of Wyoming and in Iowa, and we are dumping them in the ground because that's what we do as environmentalists. We dump crystalline quartzite and plastic turbine blades in the ground. Is there groundwater contamination? I don't know. Does anyone really care? All that matters is that we feel good about ourselves.
Yeah. It's fucking insane. We live in an insane world.
I talk a lot. I apologize.
No.
I get very on these issues. You've been a gracious host to allow me to spat off so much.
No, I talk. I mean, this is an important issue. I think what you're doing at Power of the Future, again, like, we need to change the narrative on the energy. It's not even a debate. Like, again, they're like, debate us. There is no debate.
No.
More cheap, abundant energy leads to more human flourishing. As I said, I'm in the middle of Fossil Future by Alex Epstein
now.
And I think one thing that he does great, again, I'm only halfway through, but one of my favorite parts of what he's done throughout the first half of the book is really highlight that, again, this comes down, when you get to first principles, it comes down to like the knowledge systems that are dissipating this information, like how it's framed in the media and the information that the quote unquote experts are actually using to thrust their propaganda. And when you get down to the brass tacks, first principles of what these people are spouting, it's all false. Like, it's all untrue. Yes. Like, they're not being forthright with the framing of their arguments. And so what we really need to do, what Alex does an incredible job of, is really take control of the framing. Energy use is good. Abundant, cheap energy is good. It leads to human flourishing. Anybody who is trying to take away cheap, abundant energy is anti-human. And I think that's the mirror we need to begin holding up and really leaning into. It's like, no, you're anti-human. And I think that does have a very jarring effect on people. Like, I don't want to be anti-human. I love humans. And really framing it like, no, Joe Biden, Janet Yellen, your regime that is trying to force us into unreliable, quote unquote, renewable. That's the other thing. Like, that's why, like, whenever I agree, I don't think we should adopt their vernacular. That's why I always try to say quote unquote, like, so, like, quote unquote, renewable. It's not renewable, like you just said. Like, they have very short life cycles. We need to just be, like, again, ridicule these people. Like, you're anti-human. Like, I'm not going to listen to you. You're a hypocritical anti-human leech that needs to get out of the way and let us flourish here.
And then they need to be destroyed. And the hubris of these people who don't appreciate what others have built before them, this great American economy, this great American experiment. And it is because of abundant, reliable, inexpensive energy. And they've benefited from it, from their medicines and their healthcare and their schooling and their quality of life. And rather than look at all this and say, boy, this is incredible that millions of people, again, I pencil, millions of people and millions of transactions allowed to the point that I wake up in the morning and I look at my $900 phone and I turn off the alarm and I flip on the coffee and I take a hot shower. And there's no appreciation of that to say, how is all this possible? Right. And what can I do to ensure it continues for as many people as possible? They look at it with complete cluelessness. And they think that they can create a system that will rival it. And in the process, they're plunging many, many people into poverty. And I know we're hitting on the 30 mark, but I will end it with what I said at the beginning. Watch and see when the blackouts come this summer, what neighborhoods are plunged into darkness. And that will tell you everything you need to know about your government and what they think of its people.
Be on the lookout, freaks. Daniel, thank you for coming on, number one, and more importantly, for what you're doing at Power of the Future.
Thank you.
What, if anything, can anybody listening to this podcast do to help you in your efforts at Power of the Future?
Follow us online, powerofthefuture.com. Give money, of course, because we are a C4, so I will take any and all money. But most of all, get involved at the localist level. So much of this happens at the county and local level, and that's where you need to be incredibly active. The presidential election's huge, of course. Pay attention at the local level. And when your local county commissioner says, we're going to pass a law that says Davidson County is going to be 75% renewable by, nope, that person has to be destroyed. That person's your enemy. Fight at the local level. And if you need help fighting, give us a call at powerofthefuture.com and we'll help you out.
Awesome. Well, Daniel, thank you again. It's been a fascinating conversation. Hopefully we could do it again in the future.
I would love to, and I'll talk less.
No, talk more. Talk more. This is, I ask questions. Like, this is, again, we're in an information war. We need to get as much information, good information as possible out there. So the more talking sense, the better. I think my audience got a bit smarter today.
Oh, thank you, Marty. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Daniel. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love. Ta-key!